A married man with children, living in the world, told me that he had experienced a few minutes of such divine joy that he was amazed and kept asking, "What is happening to me now?" His faith in God grew greatly. Truly, I can say that it became a strong divine reproof to my conscience, that we ought to be far more advanced spiritually. He told me that he avoids every idle conversation, about worldly matters, about idle thoughts, and is given wholly to prayer. I sat and listened to him, and I say to myself, where did this man come from now? And what is more, he even tries to honor his wife, to teach her prayer and the life of stillness. Because, on account of the world, and perhaps because he could not say it inwardly with his nous, he would say it with his mouth, at his desk, where he was, in a whisper, on the road, in the car, and everywhere he would say the prayer. And we too here, with the freedom we have, and with our abundant time as well, can pray very effectively. How shall we justify ourselves, I think, before God, when God will tell us that he gave us so many things here that help us to advance in prayer above all? We have one single care, the one that rests upon our task, our obedience, whatever it may be, and in that very task we can say the prayer very well. We have come to know, in our small praxis, our active ascetic life, and in our small first steps, that oral prayer too brings very good fruit. When God loosens the tongue, man can be united not only with creation, to come to know it, to hear its voice that speaks to man about the purpose for which God made it and what its destiny is. And by the mere fact that when one says the prayer, he redeems the time, he does not waste the time. Then the devil hears the prayer, and certainly does not draw near so easily. The one who prays avoids idle talk, chatter, and the like. But as he prays aloud, the brother beside him also hears him, who perhaps is being distracted, and at once his conscience reproves him, and he says, "But this man came here only to be saved and to pray. What am I doing? For what purpose did I come here?" And so he is prompted by his conscience and by the illumination of God, and he too begins to whisper the prayer. As he prays aloud, in the same way a man hears him, a visitor who comes to the monastery, and he too is illumined and says, "See, the monks who dwell here do not waste their time. Just so they do not live a merely formal monasticism, but they put into practice what the Apostle Paul says, 'Pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks.' This is the will of God, but it is chiefly through prayer that the real work is done within us. It is not possible, indeed by nature impossible, I can say, that this man who prays continually, even if only with his mouth, should fail to bear fruit. First, that by praying aloud a mental pathway is opened for him, so that he may afterward be able to say the prayer noetically as well. The spoken prayer greatly assists the nous in prayer. The apostles, after the ascension of the Lord, began to preach the gospel of Christ in his name. The Jews there seized them and ordered them not to preach Christ as God, and so on. And the apostle Peter raised his voice and said, 'We cannot keep silent about the things we have seen, but we will preach our teacher as the true God.' The devil comes and brings us 1,001 obstacles to prayer, with one aim, to hinder it, so that a person may never come to know the kingdom of God that lies within his own heart, buried and hidden away. Prayer illumines a person, draws him near to God, and he begins to know him. Prayer draws him near, and gives him the power to love God, even though it is God who first loves us, and only then do we love in return. Prayer bestows the peace of God within the soul. It brings peace to the inner man and quiets his conscience. It gives him courage to press on. The fathers in the desert, in the early days, did not have many books. They had nature itself as an inexhaustible book, and prayer, once it had cleansed them within, gave them the power to read this book rightly. And so the desert fathers became philosophers. As for us, because we do not have this prayer, we have not yet learned to read this book of nature. And so we need books to help us come to know something about God. This prayer, small as it is, holds such great power. The demons themselves reveal this to us by the difficulties they raise whenever someone prays, and very plainly through people who have a demon. These demons that dwell within a person cry out and bear witness to the power of this small prayer. Take a monk from a monastery in our own day. Because he had abandoned his spiritual duties, he was living away from the monastery, and being outside it, he would seize the chance to neglect his rule of prayer, his services, and the rest. His life, too, had little watchfulness in it. The result was that the devil pushed him, saying, "Now you are doing nothing. You are not going to be saved. You are never going to be freed from these evils that have now grown so great. Get up, go out into the world, and at least live out the rest of your years enjoying yourself. The years you have left can still be a pleasure to you in this life here below, since you are going to lose the other one anyway." He had no strength to set against this logismos, this intrusive thought. So one day he got up and went. He went to Cephalonia, there to St. Gerasimos, for that was his homeland. And when he came to the monastery there, a man possessed by a demon said to him, "Listen, monk, and know well what it is you're holding in your hands." The monk was holding his prayer rope. "You hold it," the demon said, "with no purpose at all. Yet it does me enormous harm. It puts fire inside me." The moment the monk heard this, at once God found him. God remembered him, and he said within himself, "What am I about to do? To hold in my hands so powerful a weapon, one that this very devil bears witness to, and I am about to throw it away. Throw away the habit too, and change my whole life, since I can see that the devil himself, who knows these things, will carry me off the day after tomorrow and condemn me to hell, knowing that I hold this only outwardly and want nothing within me." And so he returned with a different purpose, to struggle, and to beg the abbot to take him back into the monastery. And so it happened. The elder took him in. He also saw one more thing, which I will mention as well, for it teaches the same lesson. Once in his sleep, which was not exactly sleep, he saw himself high up in the heavens, hanging in the void, held by a single thread with both his hands, and beneath him a vast gaping abyss. Imagine the terror he felt. He kept saying, "If the thread should snap now, what will become of me?" And he hears a voice that says to him, "Monk, monk, take heed. By a single thread your life hangs, both this life and the other." And out of his fear he came to himself. This too helped him, and he went into the monastery. I myself was in time to know him. And after he entered the monastery, you could see him constantly saying, "Lord, have mercy," aloud and without stopping. In fact, the elder had placed him in the task there of the bread and the wine, to distribute them. He kept saying it over and over, "Lord, have mercy," and he would sigh, sighing from time to time. One day when I went there myself, I was a deacon then, to have him give me a rusk, and so on, as we newcomers usually did, he said to me, "Deacon, look here at this icon." It was of St. Theodora, the toll houses through which the soul passes. He said, "Down here this woman, Theodora, is breathing her last, and see how she will ascend through the toll houses, and how they appear before her and say, 'Here is this sin, here is that,' and try to stop her. You see the angels accompanying her, and that she has reached the throne, and now she bows in prostration and awaits the verdict." That is why he said to me, "Be attentive, deacon. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy. Lord, have mercy." That is what he told me. And he began the prayer, "Lord, have mercy. Lord, 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 have mercy." Without ceasing, he never stopped. It never left him until his soul departed. How much reproof will conscience leave me with? I keep thinking, at the hour of death, at that fearful hour when the soul thinks of 1,001 things, 1,001 truths, because the mind becomes so clear, the soul is set free, it escapes from its cares and all the rest, because it senses that in a little while it is leaving. It goes to meet the judge. It is illumined that everything is ending now. It sets out to pass through the toll houses. It feels that reality in that hour. Everything falls away, the difficulties, the delusions, the faithlessness. The passions withdraw. They have no place in that hour. And in the soul, it believes with all its being that it does not die as a soul, but departs exactly as the fathers say. That is why many times many people, worldly people especially, have told their loved ones that they are leaving in a little while, at such and such an hour. They want to see their own people, to bid them farewell as if they were leaving on a journey. These are people of little faith and piety, yet then the soul speaks to them in an entirely different way. Many times people who are stirred with emotion disturb them. What the dying one wanted was stillness, hesychia, for they feel and see and ponder what is about to happen now. Now they feel that life was false, that it was a game that was played, and that the people here too are in a way deluded, because they do not know what will happen to them, just as it now happens to me. But the one who is departing cannot say these things. Who is it that does not permit this? And the soul ponders all these things in that hour, and especially when it is a monk, who has a keener conscience and knows more, and it says, "What is happening now? Where is my time?" It begs for the time to come back so that it might pray. Just as the elder who read the books used to speak to him, so his conscience now spoke to him. Conscience says to it again, "The festival is over. Now you are setting out for the other world, and what happened happened, what you gained and what you lost. Time never comes back. You do not take back even 1 minute from the years that have passed." Then the reproof of conscience begins. Time is gone. It has left. The prayer I could have made can no longer be made, and so each one of us will set out for the other world with the reproof of conscience. And blessed is that person who was able, first by the illumination and grace of God, and then by his own small effort, to bring peace to his conscience by rendering it obedience. We hear a brother praying, and although we hear him and know and feel that I too, each one of us separately, ought to say the prayer, yet I do not have the strength. I do not press myself. I say the words slowly. I think of one thing instead of another, and I make no headway toward it. Ah, all these things will come at the hour of death. Conscience will speak them, and so many other things it may tell us. You did not do this. You did not do the other. There you grew proud. There you grieved someone. There you judged. There you told lies. Here, negligence in your duty, all of it. Our consciences will tell us these things very clearly, and so will the demons there, who have them written down with every exactness. We will be terrified when we see what they will present to us. We have forgotten these things out of human weakness, out of forgetfulness, out of many things. Though we have forgotten them, they nonetheless have them all written down there, and as our soul ascends, we will meet them before us, and then the mind will come to its senses, but it will be too late. Now, while we hear the word of God, while we hear the things that will happen to us, we must grasp these things well and lay them out before us, each of us separately, and I first of all, and say that it cannot be otherwise. I must hurry. I must struggle. I must bring peace to my conscience. One of the fathers says there is nothing more tormenting than the conscience when it accuses a person. It is a hard foretaste of what is coming. That is why, if we press ourselves toward prayer, many things will fall into place. Prayer will draw us out from all the obstacles of the devil, and little by little it will free us from the filthy passions. It will grant us divine illumination, and we will see clearly the way we must walk. Let us always commemorate, always remember death. The benefit from this remembrance is very great, and prayer too becomes more full of compunction, more fruitful. When the soul mourns within, prayer begins on its own, spontaneously. For example, if death were now at hand or drawing near, the soul would pray at once. It would beg for mercy. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, save me, do not condemn me, be merciful to my sins, and with such joy as that hour itself dictates. Let this example of the worldly man help us too, we monks, we who have received such great mercy from God. That we came here is not our own work, but purely the work of God. The mercy of God brought us here. So many millions of people are out there in the world, with all that the world puts before them. And us, he brought here. He chose us and brought us to this holy place. He presses us, he urges us on so that we may reach up above. And with the mouth, let us say the prayer. Many things will be set in order. Just as in a beehive the bees go in and out, and by the noise they make they show that they are at work making the honey. So too we monks here in this beehive of the monastery, and in each little cell, let us say the prayer continually, so that we may work the honey of virtue that sweetens a person and fills him with fragrance, both the one who prays and those who hear this prayer and see this man. The very sight of a man at prayer, its theoria, bestows something within the one who hears and sees him, and the pilgrims who come feel this especially. They come from the world, thirsting to see in the monks something otherworldly, something supernatural, something that will help them too, so that God may speak something to them within, and they may go back out into the world stronger. This is what we will give them here, if we press ourselves. But when they see us idly chattering, shouting, laughing, and even carelessly carrying on, what will they say within themselves? How are they any better than us? I say this because sometimes the devil deceives us, whether at our tasks, or at our workbenches, or when sometimes you sit and eat outside the common table, where there is no reading, and when all is said and done, even with the elder present, somehow a noisy sort of situation arises there, and when someone sees us like that, he surely will not be edified. Something like this is what St. Theodore the Studite says. He admonished his children about this too, and told them, "Did you see how those visitors came and saw you there at the workbench, praying and chanting? What beautiful words they spoke. And yet we speak in a different way when they see us not praying and not chanting. Let us watch over our life more carefully, and among us let there be no scandal, no temptation, no misunderstanding, no cause of stumbling, but let us cover everything with love." It is well known that the man who has real love within him for the brothers, whatever he may see, is not scandalized and is not offended, because love does not permit this. It does not let him be scandalized. For love always shelters, always endures with patience. It does not reckon the evil, and even when it sees evil, it turns it toward the good and finds an excuse for the case. The one who does the evil work in us is egoism. It tolerates nothing. That is why prayer is needed, to cauterize it and to put it to death. What we must again pay attention to, the most fundamental thing for the disciple under obedience, is obedience itself. We must not slip away, not do our own will, for that self-will is the poison of the soul. The first thing we will give account for as disciples is whether we kept obedience because we carry egotism within us. When the elder wants to cut off a self-will, at once the ego reacts. It protests. It does not want to bow its head. It begins at once to whisper twisted things inside the person. And if the person does not manage to shut its mouth and kill it with prayer, it will drag him off the right road. Barsanuphius calls the monk who disobeys a son of the devil. Because the obedience of Christ brought salvation to man, so too the disobedience of the first created human beings condemned him, both to this exile, where he now finds himself, and afterward to eternal condemnation. The whole task of the disciple under obedience is perfect obedience. How could a good disciple be hindered by the aerial toll houses? How could such a man lose the eternal goal and fail in his salvation? It is impossible. What good disciple was ever cast into hell, or was not crowned before God? The disciple who kept obedience will see this very thing in practice. He will know it within himself. That is, his deliverance from the passions will be a living proof that he kept the obedience that was needed. Why should we waste this precious time, when we have such freedom to struggle? What makes it hard for us now to say the prayer, and to refuse what the intrusive thought, logismos, tells us, when we are able to go forward in obedience, asking about the things we need to do? In a few words, as I have done another time in another homily, let me pin down the matter, or rather focus the struggle onto just a few things. Confessing everything, all the logismoi, and whatever happens within us. This monk will surely go forward and reach the goal he seeks. Prayer, nepsis, watchfulness, obedience, and spiritual study help a person find his goal, not only to make a good beginning, but to attain the best of ends as well. It is upon these things that we will walk. And because the time has drawn near again for me to go out, as I usually do, into the world, I beg you to have greater attention in everything, and to struggle harder, so that the grace of God may keep you safe. You will pray also for me, the wretched one, who goes out and meets 1,001 things, that God may shelter me too in a special way, for no one should rely on whatever he thinks he has. Everything belongs to God, and nothing at all is our own. And I, according to the duty I carry, always pray for you, and especially when I go out. I thank you, wherever I find myself, I do not stop the prayer. May God shelter you and help you in the struggle. And I pray that the grace of God may preserve you, and that from whatever it illumines in you, I may find you better when I see you again.